Welcome to our Mobility Management Podcast. I'm Lori Watanabe, editor of Mobility Management Magazine. And today our topic is wheelchair footprints and what lengths, widths, and turning radiuses mean in the real world, such as in the actual homes of wheelchair users. I'm sharing the microphone today with Russ Rolt, Director of Sales for PDG Mobility. Russ, welcome to our podcast and thanks for being with us today.
Lori, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, this podcast topic came from a conversation in which you were describing to me being at the home of an actual wheelchair user. And this was in the northeastern United States where row houses are really common. And Russ, you mentioned something that just amazed me. You said this power wheelchair user, once he entered his kitchen, had to drive outside of his home to be able to turn around. He literally had to go out the door, turn around outside, and then drive back inside because his kitchen was so narrow that he couldn't turn within that kitchen. Do you remember telling me about that?
I do, Lori. It was really a crazy thing. I got a call to go out initially for the client to just help him with what we thought was just a battery charger issue. And I'm born and raised in the Northeast. I'm right outside of Philadelphia. And this guy was in the heart of the city in Philadelphia in a very confined area. And when I pulled up to his home, I noticed this, instead of just a ramp, a very large platform at his back door. And I was like, that's kind of weird use of the space, but didn't give it another thought. And then I went in the house, I checked out his battery charger, and we were in his kitchen. He said, let me go turn around. I'll be right back. And then they opened the door and I didn't quite get what was going on. And I watched him drive out onto the platform, turn around, and then come back in so that he could change directions within his kitchen. It was amazing to me that this vital thing that was just missed at some point in the process, and he actually had to do that, and then it was accommodated by building him a giant platform. It just really took me back.
Yeah, that was such an amazing story that it really stuck with me, and that's what led to our conversation today, which is understanding what a wheelchair footprint really is and why wheelchair width in this situation required this client to go outside and turn around. So let's start talking right there. What impact does width have when it comes to the environment, and what's the difference, for instance, between a power chair width and a manual chair width? Does one or the other offer more flexibility or narrower width than the other?
We'll start with the second part of that, and then we'll come back to the beginning. Power chairs, generally speaking, are going to offer you a narrower footprint because you're sitting on top of the wheels rather than between them. So, you know, in my current world, in the manual chair world, we're always looking at seat width plus, where in many cases with power chairs, when you're sitting on top of the wheels, your seat width or your outer point of your armrest is going to be your widest point. And I've had circumstances in my former life as a provider where that was part of the process in the assessment. It wasn't the primary driving force, but there were cases where power was something that was leaned towards simply because it would go through spaces where a manual chair wouldn't. As far as width goes, it's a very vital measurement that we need to have for sure. I think it's the easy one that people go to and they say very simply, okay, well, the doorway is 32, how wide's the wheelchair? That's the first thing people look at. But what doesn't get factored in is where you're turning from. Is it a 90-degree turn? How wide is the area you're turning from? So length could be just as critical as width in actually maneuvering within the home.
So you bring up a great point, is that it's really easy to get a tape measure and measure a doorway and then measure the wheelchair and think, okay, we're great because the wheelchair width is smaller than the doorway width, so we're fine. But Let's talk about what wheelchair users will encounter in their actual homes, not just narrow hallways or doorways, but doorways and entrances that can require these very sharp turns to maneuver through. So you've seen this situation as both a wheelchair provider and as a manufacturer. So what does the seating and mobility team really need to consider when speccing that wheelchair to make sure it fits well into the client's lifestyle and into the environment?
I, whenever possible, always like conceptually to try to physically access all of the rooms that the client needs to access with the actual chair or as close as possible to it. It just gave me a feel for not only will it make it or not, but how difficult will it be? And especially with power, when you have somebody who's in that early learning curve of proficiency in driving power, you know, are they going to be able to make it to the bathroom in a timely manner when they haven't yet completely mastered their driving? And that can set people up for failure. If they have failure, then they're less likely to use the equipment. And then we get that age-old problem where our tax dollars become a coat hanger or a book holder on the side of the room, where people will say, well, it never worked for me, or I could never get it to work properly, and all of those other things. But we've just set them almost up for failure by introducing them to an environment that isn't really conducive. So I think, given the opportunity, I would always prefer to physically trial it and go through the home. But I also need to find out what the priorities are and where you need to get to. So if you just look at a bedroom door, but don't realize that the bathroom that they're going to use, because of size or because of the ability to transfer, is in another part of the house. It's really the whole picture. Where do you need to get to? Let's make sure you can get to all of those. And the big question is, you know, if you own your home, is there an ability to modify? And if you don't, if you're renting, what accommodations will your landlord make to help you be able to access your environment?
It's not just knowing the width, length, and turning radius of a wheelchair. That's not really necessarily enough in real life. What you're saying is that we really need to know how the wheelchair is going to behave and how that consumer is going to use it, depending on how sharp a turn needs to be made into that bathroom, for example, and how easy it is to make that turn regularly. And I know that, for instance, also different wheelchair configurations, as far as power chairs, having the drive wheels in different places, that also is part of the equation as to how that chair moves and how it turns as well, right? So we need to say that measurements are more than just numbers on paper. Is it fair to say that we need to think about them beyond that?
I would completely, absolutely agree with that. And, you know, the drive wheel configuration is kind of a sub-selection. You know, once we've decided manual versus power, if power is indeed the route we're going, then drive wheel selection becomes critical. And, you know, for those of us who've been at this forever, back in the days where everything was rear wheel drive, if you can think, if you only had that at your disposal now, as good as it is for certain clients, how many people would simply not access the home? The numbers would be staggering. But now, with really the proliferation of front wheel and mid wheel drive, we have so many more options for drive configuration that we can get to where we need to go better than we ever were, you know, in the past. It still requires really a complete, we throw around the term evaluation all the time, but it's not just measuring, it's evaluating the combination of all these different things to get the best possible outcome.
Okay, so my last question is where to start when you're working with a client who lives in a home that is largely tight dimensions that are also fixed. Maybe making modifications to that home is not possible because the person is renting, or maybe it's just the overall architecture and structure of the home where you can't just take out walls and widen and make this huge great room that has no restrictions whatsoever. So, Russ, you've been in ATP. You've worked as both a provider and a manufacturer. So when you're facing someone who you know lives in a pretty tight space, where do you start? And what are some of the questions that either you ask right away, you ask the client or the caregiver, or at least they're in your head, they're in your mind as you're kind of working through the evaluation process? Where do you start when you are thinking about what kind of chair would be best?
Honestly, I have, and I don't even know who to give credit for this phrase for, but when I started doing this, what seems like forever ago, someone made a statement to me, and I cannot remember who said it, but it has absolutely resonated. And every time I do this, I think of this one simple phrase: whenever you give something, you take something away. So ultimately, and this is involved in, you know, the clinical assessment, it's involved in the mat evaluation, it's involved in everything. Whenever we give something, we take something away. So we are ultimately the arbiters of what we provide and what we give up, and helping people make the decision on what's acceptable. So for example, maybe on a power chair, a power center mount foot plate will take up less overall footprint than conventional elevating leg rests. But maybe that puts our feet too close together and doesn't enable the person to position their lower extremities as well as we would like. This is an ultimate example of giving something and taking something away. I can't position your feet quite as well as I would like on the center mount foot platform. However, I can get you into your bathroom. Let's discuss this. Let's come up with a plan. Is there an alternative? So ultimately, if we go into this with knowing that we have, for everything we provide, we're taking something away, and that we have that really tremendous obligation to make sure we go through that with the client, I think one of the things that some people miss is really getting information from the client. We always ask a million questions when we're doing the clinical assessment, but we don't ask them what's important to them as much in the home. Where do you want to get to? And if you have to give something up, what would it be? And some clients clearly won't know. And if there's family members to help as well, it's certainly valuable information, as much as we can get, we'll take. But it's really deciding ultimately what are the most important things for you to accomplish in that environment and the most important places to get to. If you can't modify anything, it can present some challenges, and ultimately it can put people in the wrong mobility product because of the environment that they're in. And, you know, we've all, I think, as people in this industry, when we see somebody and we question the selection, and I think we all do it, and we all look at the work, and you look at the little tag on the back and say, I wonder who did that. Well, a lot of times there's a reason, and it's a reason that we can't see, and many, many times it's environmental. So I think there's a lot of things that go into the selection, as far as I can't really simplify it into one thing that I focus on. But if I keep in mind that I'm the arbiter of that seesaw and I can control what we give and what we get, at the end, at least I know that I've given the client as much of what they want and they've understood thoroughly what the limitations are with the selections they've made. And if I see something egregious, I think I have an obligation to kind of give them my opinion. And they can take it or leave it, but I'm going to give them my opinion on what I think makes a lot of sense. And ultimately, if they've entrusted me with the opportunity to provide their mobility, they're trusting me, period. So I need to let them know that my recommendations aren't based on anything other than their best interest. And they get to kind of piggyback on the fact that it's not my first rodeo. And you know, I've done this a few times, and these are what I base this off of. It's not just, you know, I'm on day one on the job and I'm trying to figure this out as I go. I've done a few of these, and these are what has happened in the past. So I think we all, because of, you know, measurements and evaluations and clinical assessments, really, really focus our energies on that. And I think the reality of it is, especially in this time crunch world that we're in, ATPs, it's very difficult to go out and just do a home assessment. And I think some people kind of rush through it. I think there may be an occasion where somebody sends a tech out to say, hey, let me know what you think. I think we need to prioritize and increase the importance of doing just that and making sure that we put the same effort into that we put into the clinical assessment. When we miss things in the clinical assessment, I mean, I think that's less and less now because of the level of proficiency that we have both clinically and just the level of quality of ATPs that are out there now. I don't think we miss much now. I do think we miss more than we should in the home assessment.
Well, that's really a great perspective. I think that this is more than just taking out a tape measure and measuring. We're doing a good job of that as an industry, but really mm-hmm. having a conversation and expanding past just the numbers on a sheet of paper or the numbers being put mm-hmm. into your iPad, and really thinking about, in a real-life scenario, where are you likely to be in your house? Where are the most important places for you to be able to access quickly and efficiently? And having that conversation, it sounds like that can go a long way to reducing the disappointment and the surprises on the delivery end. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. There's little things, and I think ultimately, you know, we have both the obligation, you know, to be, you know, our continuing education, but just an obligation to do the best job that we can to know what's available out there to help people with these fixed measurements and fixed environments. Little things like offset hinges for a door. You know, if you open a door, you have the thickness of the door that sticks in. That can make the difference in whether or not a chair can make the turn to get into the room. If you can use an offset hinge, which I last checked was about $20 or $25, and you could replace them in a rental property with the original hinges if you absolutely had to, that will save just those couple of inches, and that can make the difference on whether or not you make it. But there can be just really little aesthetic things where somebody has a piece of art or a piece of furniture in a certain place that has, you know, significant value to them emotionally. It was a gift from a loved one that's no longer with us, or, well, I have to have that. Okay, I understand. Can we move it? Can we put it in a better place? So not only do you have it, but you have access to your bathroom. Little things like that, that, you know, if we take the time and we're thorough, those things are the technology's obviously been available for us for years. And it's just asking those questions, but realizing, okay, if I move this piece of art or piece of furniture that your aunt gave you, the good side is we'll get you in the right place. What you're giving up is that sight line at that particular thing, which the other fascinating thing that I've found in my travels is in all of the end users that I've met, there's been a lot of occasions where there's 20 reasons to do something. And one, what will seem pretty arbitrary and unimportant to me, reason not to. And I've had places and times where that one reason wins. And that's the most important thing for that person. So ultimately, we need clinical feedback, obviously, but we need patient feedback. Talk to me. Tell me what you want. Tell me what you want to accomplish. And don't sugarcoat it. And if I can't do it, I won't sugarcoat it back either. I'll tell you what I think. But tell me what's important to you, because my mind reading technology is on the fritz and I can't do it. So I'd much rather hear it from you.
That is awesome. I love that collaborative spirit, and also taking into account that this is complex rehab. Everybody is different. Everybody has unique needs and goals, and sometimes it will be that one thing out of 20. Mm-hmm. The only problem out of the 20 sometimes is going to be what you really have to base your decision on.
It's like watching one of those, you know, shows on TV where you're in the courtroom and, well, the preponderance of evidence, but then there's one thing. And
right.
That throws the court case out the window. So, I mean, it's making sure we don't also impart our biases on something that clearly wouldn't be important to us, but is very important to that individual. We need to prioritize it the way that they have.
I love it. That was great. And Russ, thanks so much for sharing your ideas on this very real world topic. I appreciate your sharing a microphone with me, and thanks as well to our listeners. Mobility Management podcasts are available for listening and downloading on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And the best way to be sure you don't miss any of our podcasts is to subscribe. You can go to our website, mobilitymgmt.com, to listen there as well. Thank you very much for joining us. Russ, thanks so much, and we'll be back again soon.
Thanks, Laura. I appreciate you having me.